What's up, peeps? Before you get into the episode, just a quick message. Did you know that Rebranded Safety is brought to you by RiskFluent? Rebranded Safety is essentially our campaign to achieve our purpose, which is to make the working world better by rebranding safety one interaction at a time. We value a people-centered approach that delivers positive impact on the risk. We deliver three types of services: technical, transformational, and fire. It's the last two I want to talk to you about. If you value what we value and you want some support driving a culture change or decluttering your safety systems, or you want to improve human performance, then it's our transformational support that can help you. Or maybe you want a highly experienced registered fire risk assessor to carry out an assessment on your building, design an emergency plan, or review the fire safety design for your new building, then it's our fire support service that can help you. But before you get in touch with us, it's important that you want to have impact on the actual risk and you value a people-centered approach. If you don't, that's fine. You'll find someone that can help you. But if you do value those, then get in touch with us at riskfluentltd.com or email me, james@riskfluentltd.com. But for now, I'll let you get into the episode.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Today we're talking all about modern slavery. It's something that safety professionals are getting given, whether they like it or not. Some of them are choosing to take it on. Let's jump into the intro and I'll tell you some more about today's guest.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution or one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by RiskFluent.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button and the bell and all those magical algorithm thingamajigs. So today we're talking all about the modern slavery within normal businesses, what that looks like. Today we're talking to a guy that does some amazing stuff. He's a ex-journalist now that focuses on raising awareness for modern slavery and mostly does that on his bike. So as you know, I'm a bit of a cyclist myself when I can get time to go out and do it. And I kind of caught this guy sharing loads of cycling posts and I was like, what's this? And had his tagline around modern slavery and we had a chat and I was like, oh my God, we need to talk to you. But before we get into that, let's have a little bit of a shout out to our sponsors. So firstly, thank you to the official sponsor of the podcast and YouTube channel, Paradigm Human Performance, and more specifically, the HSE subscription service. Paradigm Human Performance is just an outstanding company. They're human and organizational performance experts. They're all about getting worker safety is part of the DNA of as many companies as possible. They have a global goal of just teaching and helping people learn, and they do that in so many amazing ways. The HSE subscription service is more focused around those small, medium-sized enterprises, those kind of businesses that are really struggling to kind of juggle all the balls and spin all the plates, and maybe sometimes safety becomes something that maybe falls into the back of your consciousness. It's there and you're doing it, but maybe you could do a little bit better. And that's what this package is for. It's going to help you put worker safety as part of your DNA. It's going to help you utilize the subject matter expertise of that worker as well. And obviously, because they're human organizational performance specialists, this is going to have HOP, HOP, whatever you want to call it, woven throughout. But this is not the kind of compliance system that you need to then kind of declutter when you've read a book about HOP or something like that. This is kind of already done. So if you want to get compliant, whether it's industry compliance, general regulatory compliance, but also you want to have human safety and that kind of human-centered approach woven into what you do, this is the solution for you. Starting from £99 a month, you can contact Paradigm HP. Down below, there's a phone number, email address. There's also their website. So if you're not quite sure about this, go check out their website. You can sign up to the Learning Organization webinar. It's an outstanding webinar. It runs every Thursday at 2 p.m. UK time. But not only that, once you've signed up to it, you can access the whole backlog of all of these webinars. And they've been going for about 2 years now. And there's just an absolute wealth of information. So go check that out. Well, I'm there pretty much every Thursday if I can make it. Just another shout out to my and Colin's company, Project Meletium. Project Meletium is a mastermind community, as far as we're aware, the only mastermind community for the safety and risk profession. So if you're working in health and safety or kind of operational risk or any type of risk management, you're welcome. 100%. Hey, even if you don't work in that space, maybe you're an operational person that manages safety and risk. We've got a director of operations that's one of our members because they manage health and safety and risk within their role. And they're a member and they love it. It's all about the community, helping each other develop and solve problems and improve business, improve work, but ultimately improve our profession as well. We do that through weekly community calls, a monthly philosophy call, a monthly book club, and a quarterly wagon wheel, which is like a big mastermind event for 3 hours, keynote workshops, real in-depth focus sessions, like nothing you've seen before. This is way more than a webinar. These are in-depth, open, honest, emergent conversations. You want to try it out completely free of charge. You can email me or message me or DM me, whatever you want to do. Just contact me, all the details below, or contact Colin Nottage and we'll get you in one of our community calls completely free of charge. You can try it out before you buy it. Or if you're hooked already, go to www.projectmeletium.com and you can go to the join us page and join us straight away. I look forward to seeing you on one of our calls. Okay, let's get into today's conversation with an amazing gentleman who raises awareness, is a massive advocate for the elimination of modern day slavery. Something that maybe you like me think not really a thing in England, or the UK, even Europe maybe. Well, it's an interesting conversation and I think it'll open many of your eyes and it will show that we've got a lot more to do. And we also get an insight into what Gordon's doing. So unfortunately, we didn't get this out in time. We had every intention of putting this podcast out before he did what he was doing, which is riding around the Premiership clubs on his bike to raise awareness for modern day slavery. But our guest today, Gordon Miller, is doing some amazing work. Let's hear from him. He can educate us all. And if you want to check him out, all of his details are in the description as well. Let's get into the conversation. Gordon, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, that's all right, mate. Looking all dapper. Let's why don't you give us an introduction to yourself and then we'll talk into why you look so dapper, I'm sure. So, give us a bit of an introduction to yourself and who Gordon Miller is, and then we'll get into the chit-chat.
Yeah, nice one. So, Gordon Miller, team leader of Ride for Freedom, as it says on the jersey. So Ride for Freedom is the... Our mission is SDG 8.7 aligned mission is to utilize the universal appeal and power of cycling to deliver positive social impacts and to raise specifically to raise awareness, educate and forge partnerships to end modern slavery. So that's essentially who we are and what we do. My background is as a journalist formerly. Don't practice so much these days, but I work in communications and I run a communications business, which is the sort of the introduction, if you like, to how I came to be working around the whole modern slavery, sustainability, environmental agenda through doing a lot of work with clients around this particular area. So that was my sort of introduction back in 2015, 2016 to the whole sort of social agenda around modern day slavery and business and human rights. And that sort of catalyzed my lifelong of interest around justice. As a journalist, I was writing a lot around issues that affected, not necessarily from a political perspective, but I was writing about issues around sustainability and how this sort of impacts people and then the environmental aspects of that and the social aspects. So it's kind of, you know, bringing together these three things of my communication skill set, my interest in social justice and sustainability and environmentalism and social justice, and then my passion for cycling, which is not all that, you know, I sort of cycled a lot as a kid, but I didn't really cycle a great deal for about 20 years. And I took it up again about 10, 11 years ago now, and increasingly got more and more sort of interested and passionate about it. And these kind of challenges that I'm doing now are sort of born of trying to keep myself motivated, giving myself goals and challenges to keep getting up and keep getting out and putting the miles in. So that's kind of where all this, the genesis of all this came from.
I think it's such a common thing that cyclists either, there's like two types of, well, there's like three types of cyclists. There's the people that have just got on a bike and never got off, and it's like pretty much their job now, or their entire life. Or there's like the majority of people split into, I find, two groups. People like you and I that as a kid rode bike, probably loved it, and then just kind of really just maybe took it for granted, or like, I've always loved bikes, like always loved push bikes, but like, yeah, it was just a means to, I mean, I didn't drive until I was like 20, 21, and I just got around everywhere on a bus and a bike. Everywhere, it was just like, I just bike everywhere, and I addicted and still am addicted to like the bike messenger community. Like, you've watched a film with Queen Latifah years and years and years ago called Taxi, and there's like a scene in it of a bike messenger, and I was just like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. And it's like, I actually worked as a courier back when I was at uni, came down to, and I worked as a courier on a bike for a while. That was a very cool job. Quite dangerous as well back in the day. Mm. I did it in central London, so it was pretty, not on the best bikes, you know. I remember one time getting my chain fell off and locked, and I went skidding off down the road. Wasn't pretty, and it hurt a bit as well. But I'm with you. It's kind of that I've always messed around on bikes, particularly as a kid, and then sort of, you know, had, when I first moved to central London, getting the tube and all that sort of stuff, didn't really bother with the bike that much after I finished uni. Once I started work, it was, there were no showers back in the day, you know, no workplace shower. Yeah. It's not like, not these days where a lot of offices have them, so it wasn't that convenient to cycle a lot and so on. So I kind of, you know, had a 10, 15, even 20 year period where I didn't, well, not 20, probably 15 years where I didn't cycle that much. And then, just got back into it. But yeah, love it now. Love it. Mm. Couldn't imagine not doing it.
Mm. I've got a bit of a personal war on at the moment with East Midlands Rail, because I love riding my bike in London. I don't go there that much, but we've got an office in London in my day job. So I'll literally just jump on the train, book a slot for the bike, get off at St. Pancras, and then just bike to the office. And I love it. Like, it's one of my favorite things to do. I'm just like you say, it's pretty risque. Like, it's a bit precarious at certain points, and I just love it. And they've recently changed all of the trains before 10 a.m. to these electric connect trains, but they've got no bike slots on, and you're not allowed full size bikes on. And I was just like, so you've just made that decision and completely stopped my way of going to work now. And based on what? Like, I've now got to either buy a tube ticket or pay for the tube using my card and that, or hire a Boris bike, which I just can't bring myself to do, but still pay money, or walk, which would like double, if not triple, the length of the time of my commute. I'm just like, what idiot said, let's do this, and just not have any bikes options, like, or buy a folding bike. They said, oh, why don't you buy a folding bike? And I was like, because I don't want a folding bike. Like, I love my commuter bike. Like, I love it. I'm just so pissed off with them. I never complained about anything, but it's proper peed me off. I'm in London twice this week, and I would have really loved to get out on the bike.
Yeah. It's just so disjointed as well, isn't it? You know, the whole infrastructure is supposed to be gearing up more for cycling, and yet there you go. There's an example of a rail provider who just unilaterally makes this decision to sort of not allow bikes any longer. So that connectivity is then gone, and it's it forces people back onto, you know, public transport, or it forces them into public, into their own cars again, and all that sort of nonsense. It's just, well, you know, it shouldn't be done without consultation first and foremost, and it frankly shouldn't be done at all. But
anyway.
Anyway,
let's get on to the subject. So you're obviously kind of your biggest thing that we're going to talk about today is you mentioned sustainability as well, but today we'll kind of focus on the kind of ride for slavery and freedom. So you're talking primarily about modern slavery. Do me a favor and just kind of explain what that is. And then from there, I think we'll get into it, because when we had our initial chat just over the phone, there was, whilst I was aware of it and knew of it, and there's a lot of people in the safety profession that end up taking this stuff on, I don't think actually we realise, especially in the UK, actually how big of an issue this is. So just start off, if you could, with like an explanation of what modern slavery is, and then we'll go from there.
Cool. Yeah. So let me give you a definition, if I may. This is one not written myself, but written by Professor Kevin Bales, who's Professor of Contemporary Slavery at the Rights Lab at Nottingham University, which is one of the sort of most elite and esteemed educational facilities in the UK, working on this issues around modern day slavery. And Kevin defines it as when a person is under the control of another person who applies violence and force to maintain that control, and the goal of that control is exploitation. So I think for me, the real key word in there is around exploitation, control and exploitation. And I think, you know, as you said, when we originally spoke, it was, there's often a perception that this is about people being literally chained, you know, and it's an unhelpful imagery that's presented and largely, you know, inaccurate. I mean, very, very few people are literally chained, although, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't ever happen. They may be chained at night, for example, or they may be, you know, restrained at night so that they can't escape. That may happen. But I'm saying the majority of these issues is around psychological control and coercion. So people are sort of intimidated into situations where they're exploited for their labor. So to give you an example, quite a prevalent situation is where you get workers, for example, in Romania and Bulgaria, and these aren't just countries I picked at random. These are the national referral mechanism. Most countries where most of the victims who are in the UK are actually documented as coming from. So it's not stigmatizing certain countries. It's based on historical facts. But for instance, those people are recruited by and invariably by criminal gangs in these countries, and they are offered jobs. Effectively, they're promised jobs, well-paid jobs. There isn't, for example, there may not be much work in their own countries. They're offered better-paid jobs, housing, etc., etc., and invited to come over to the UK. And often, you know, because the likes of Romania, when we were in the EU, they had freedom of movement, so they could come here. So they weren't; it wasn't illegal. Although some people, they're not within the EU. So that's, those people are then trafficked into the country. But in this case, let's continue the example of Romanian workers. So they're enticed over here. And when they get here, they have a passport. When they get here, the passport's taken off them. So immediately when they have your passport taken off, you then lose your freedom of movement because you can't get out of the country without a passport. So you're then enthralled to that particular gang that's holding you at their will. They will then, for example, say to you, well, of course, you know, that individual could go to the police, but often the person will be intimidated by the gang into saying, well, if you go and report this, if you want to take it to the authorities, then we know where your family lives in Romania, for example. We know where your family lives in, you know, wherever your home country is. We will do them in, you know, we have that control over you. So immediately you've got that emotional control over somebody. Well, what are they going to do? You know, if they don't comply, they run the risk of their family being threatened, being assaulted, whatever. So that's a huge immediate emotional control that people have over them. that then start to, you know, these things incrementally, this sort of oppression gets ratcheted up, where it's like, okay, you know, you come home, I want some of your wages. You earn £100 a day. I'm taking 80 quid of that. I'm going to give you 20 quid back because I put you up in the housing because you had nowhere to live. So I've given you the housing. I'm taking 80 quid of that back. I'm justifying it by taking 80 quid back for your rent, and I'll give you 20 quid back to live off, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see how this pattern builds up. And before very long, they no longer have any autonomy. They can't report it to the authorities. They have no passport to leave. They are completely and utterly controlled by this criminal gang, which is seeing this individual as a commodity, to make their money. And it's a very, very lucrative way of making money for criminal gangs. There was some study done a couple of years ago that estimated it's something like £150 billion a year trade, in people, in people exploitation. So it's a massive, isn't that frightening? That's absolutely staggering, £150 billion. It's astonishing, really. But that's essentially how it comes about. You know, it's through coercion in many, many cases, and it's a controlled situation. And that's kind of the definition, and that's how it comes about. But there are lots of different sort of forms of modern day slavery, which, you know, I could go into, because modern day slavery is an umbrella term. Human trafficking, for example, sits under the modern slavery umbrella. So does forced labor, which is kind of one of the issues I'm talking about here, is around forced labor, people being forced to work against their will through threat of punishment. Debt bondage. We don't tend to see that so much in the UK, but it's often things that it happens in countries like India and subcontinent, places like that, where people are trapped in poverty and they're forced to borrow money, and then they have to work off that debt, if you like. So that's where this term debt bondage comes from. And they can never get out of debt bondage because, you know, they may pay back a quid, but then the person who's oppressing them says, well, actually, your rent this month, I'm putting your rent up to £1.50 this month or this week or this day or whatever, and I'm only paying you a pound. So the debt continually grows, and it can even be passed on generationally.
Jesus Christ.
How shocking is that? Do you know what I mean? So you have literally, you know, debts passed on down from, you know, grandchildren, from grandparents to parents to grandchildren. So, you know, it's just this heinous situation where it's just boom, 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 ratcheted on and on and on. Obviously, slavery of children. This year is the United Nations year for the elimination of child slavery, 2021. It was literally anti-child slavery day was on the 10th of June. Was it the 12th of June? 12th of June. But this year is really focusing on that. And there are something, let me just give you this figure. It's an absolutely shockingly large figure. Something like, there was a report on only very recently by UNICEF, which revealed that there's actually been an increase in the amount of children in slavery for the first time in about 20 years, where there's been an increase, which is an absolutely shocking state of affairs. There are something like, let me just give you this figure. Where is it? I'll have to dig it out. But they estimate something like one in four victims of modern day slavery are children. So if there are 40.3 million people worldwide, then you can do the maths with that. You know, there are some 10 million or more children who are victims of modern day slavery. So that's, again, as I say, that's another form of modern day slavery. Then you've got things like domestic servitude, which we do see in the UK, where people are, they come over to do jobs for rich families, nannies and things like that. And before long, they can be trapped in this situation where they're forced to work longer hours than they're contracted to. They aren't, they're stopped from leaving the house on the days off and things like this. And this becomes, becomes a form of modern day slavery. And of course, the worst single or the biggest numerically that former modern day slavery is sexual exploitation. So women and girls account for 99% of these people who are victims of commercial sex industry, and that accounts for something like 58% they maintain of all the people who are in modern day slavery are forced into sexual exploitation work. You go back to this analogy of the criminal gangs and how lucrative it is. Well, if you can earn £100 a day by putting somebody to work on a building site, for example, but you can earn £500 a day by forcing a woman into prostitution, and they see a person as a commodity, what are they going to do? They're going to force women into sex work, because that's where they'll make most of their money. So all in all, it's to use a terrible word. It's horrible. It's a horrible situation, isn't it? It's 40 million people globally, children, men, women. It's right across the board. There is no sort of discrimination. Just absolutely appalling. And that's kind of moral outrage is kind of one of the things that really sort of fired me up initially when I started engaging on this subject. Was like, how can this be in the 21st century, you know, that we can have this situation, and it's getting worse, you know, in the forms of child labor. That 40.3 million people global enslaved globally at any given time, that is, there's no fixed time, you know, that is like today, tomorrow. That's an estimated figure done by the Global Slavery Index. And again, it's about 2 or 3 years old. I think it was 2018 when that figure was last calculated. So hopefully there'll be another study soon, which will at least give us an up-to-date figure, and God forbid if it's gone up, but it may well have done, because the social conditions that we're seeing at the moment through the COVID has been directly attributed to the growth in the number of child slaves. By this report that was done by UNICEF and who the other partner was, but UNICEF were involved in it. So it's gone up as a result of this, because there is less protection for workers. There's greater exploitation, potential for greater exploitation. There's less protection. So it's a horrible, you know, terrible situation, and getting worse in many respects. I just dropped something. The situation when it comes to, well, you know, what can we all do about it? Well, you know, obviously from my perspective, I'm raising awareness, trying to educate people, and obviously forge partnerships to help the, you know, support the eradication of this. But I think really fundamental to all this is how businesses start to address the issue, because all businesses, they have a compliance perspective. You know, the law, the Modern Slavery Act, for example, in the UK, requires all businesses with a turnover of over £36 million a year to formally submit an annual statement, modern slavery statement, on which they have to report in six key areas around what they're doing to try and understand, manage, and mitigate their the risk in their supply chain, not only in their direct operations, but really, really critically in their supply chain, which is called Section 54 and of the Modern Slavery Act. And it's actually fundamental in trying to eradicate modern slavery that businesses start to sort of, as I say, map and do their due diligence into their own supply chain, so they understand where the risks are. And where they find it, they do something about it, which is really, really critical. And all the sort of the businesses that are really engaging around this, for example, the likes of Marshalls PLC, which there are businesses in landscaping and landscaping materials and you know, all that sort of flags and slabs and concrete and all that sort of stuff. They've done a lot of exhaustive work around this for about a decade now. And, you know, they are the first ones to admit that, you know, if you look hard enough, you will find modern slavery in your supply chain. So those businesses that sort of turn around and say, hey, we don't have it, we're not included in this, is an absolute fallacy, because they're not looking hard enough. Because they may not have it in their tier one, but they'll certainly find it if they go into their tier two, their tier three suppliers, etc., etc. And that's where it's fundamental that we start that companies do this due diligence into digging down into their supply chains, so that they can actually start to identify where it exists, and then, as I say, try and do something about it by putting processes in place, supporting the communities where they find that there is in transactions going on which are to do with modern day slavery, and start, it's called, you know, remediation process. They actually start to support them to improve the lot of the workers. You know, why are they exploiting them? It can be, you know, for example, in India and places like that, it's not seen as modern day slavery. It's just a cultural situation, you know, where kids are put to work, you know, and it's, you have to be sensitive to that, because you can't walk in here and say, well, in the UK, you know, we have the law that says nobody can work from under the age of 16. Yeah. You know, have to be sensitive to this, and you'll know about this, working in the OSH industry. You know, you have to be sensitive to the local areas as well, and the local cultures and regulations too. But it has to start somewhere, and that's where I think, you know, businesses really have a good, you know, where this Modern Slavery Act, which we have one in Australia, there's one in this California Transparency Act in California, obviously. Germany's just instituted a Supply Chain Act as well. So gradually there's sort of more and more legislation evolving around the world, which is starting to address all these things. And there are several voluntary mechanisms as well, like the United Nations Guiding Principles, which requires all companies to respect human rights and to understand, again, what modern slavery being obviously one of the human rights, addressing that. How companies and businesses can go about trying to understand their human rights impacts. And that, again, it's a voluntary mechanism rather than a compliance issue. But the forward-thinking businesses understand that this is a necessary and an advantageous thing to address, not only for them, not only for the wider society, but also for themselves as a business. And I think that's really where this gets very critical.
Blimey.
There's a lot there.
There's a lot to break down there. I want to kind of break a few bits that you've kind of touched on there. Like, this is obviously a massive issue globally.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of us in the UK would probably think, to one of your earlier points, like, it's not us. But like, yeah. So like, and I think we naively would just, and I would have been, you know, I'm not judging anyone, like, no. Until I spoke to you the first time around, I was like, yeah, but this is just an issue for like third world countries, surely it's not an issue for us over here. But then you've got companies like Marshalls that are saying, if you look hard enough, you will find it. Like, that's a massive statement to make. Like, you will find it in your supply chain. Like, really?
Yeah. And, you know, it's in their opinion and other people's opinion, it's unquestionable that you will find it if you look hard enough, because, you know, it is so endemic, you know, 40 million people at that last reckoning globally. You know, if you know, let me just put a bit of context around that. Obviously, if you're, you know, not all businesses are importing stuff, not all businesses have long supply chains, you know, into the developing world and places like that. But you know, if you sort of break it down into, you know, just look at your, you know, the laptop, we look at all the equipment that we're using around us, it all has microchips in it. It all has bits of, you know, I don't know, components in them, which are basically mined in places like Africa and South America and places like that, which end up getting put into all our products. Invariably, you will find that those products, you know, if you actually start to look deeper into them, there's exploitation that goes on in the mining communities. You know, so it touches every one of our lives in every day, you know. So this is just as individuals. I think Unseen, the national charity which runs the Modern Slavery Helpline, which Ride for Freedom is working on the Free Will program. Just briefly, the Free Will, we've instituted a program called Free Will, which is a program to support victims of modern day slavery in the UK to cycle. So we're giving them a bike, we're giving them a helmet, a lock, light, giving them some basic training and some road awareness skills. And then, you know, the intention is that once we've proven this project works, we're going to roll it out around the country. So we're starting off a pilot program with Unseen. But unseen, to the point that I'm making here around unseen, is that they've they estimate, you know, that at any one time, you know, we each have, if you like, if we were to break this down, six slaves working for us. You know, if we look at our lifestyle, you look at our lifestyle, the computers that we have, the products that we buy, you know, the clothes that we buy, if we don't buy ethically, you know, we don't look into the supply chain, it is tainted with modern day slavery. So, you know, your cars, you know, everything around us, because of the way that the Western world has outsourced
everything.
Everything. Yeah. We don't manufacture anything here. We're just a service industry, a service sector, UK PLC is a service based economy. So, you know, we've just pushed this problem away, you know, and you could argue, you know, we get very, very cheap prices. You know, our standard of living is basically built on other people's slavery. Now, you know, I'm not being political here, and I'm not an overtly political person, but you could argue, you know, that is a reality, that, you know, if you wanted to look at it in that way, that our whole economy is built on other people's slavery.
Well, I think you have to have that, for me, it's not political. I think it's just sensible to see how big of an issue this is, like, and having that in your head that whilst you can contribute actually to, you know, with what you're doing and raising awareness, and then what a listener of this podcast could do, could have a actionable impact on this by doing something within their company, 100%. But I think it is good to just have that system thinking kind of thought process to see, okay, but what else am I doing to contribute to this stuff that's unknown to me? For example, I don't know if you've watched it, but there's an amazing series on Netflix called Rotten, about basically the corruption of the food industry. And there's avocados, there's drug cartels in Mexico that no longer deal in drugs. They deal in avocados because there's more money in it.
Wow.
And I'm just like, I'm sorry, what? you know, depending on where you buy your avocados for, but even if I wanted, I remember watching it and being like, well, I just get my avocados from Tesco or Sainsbury's. Yeah. Like, are they doing something to make sure it's not coming from the cartel? And I just assume they are, but like, yeah. And that's the same with modern slavery, I suspect. It's just like, I assume those big brands are doing it. And if they're not doing it, then I kind of assume this is more of a black market issue, and it's just those dodgy brands that are those dodgy companies that we don't really know much about. But actually, to your point, this is probably there more than what we think it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you know, some of the supermarkets are doing a lot of work around, you know, their responsible sourcing practices, as the terminology has it. You know, so, you know, they do look into their supply chains. But as you say, I mean, it is, there are often layers upon layers of black market economy. You know, it's not going to be easily, you know, found that, it, you know, unless you're an investigative journalist or something like that, you know, who's actually behind some of these farms. You know, there'll be a paper trail that's very, very opaque that you'll never actually find out who the owner is. So I'm not accusing anybody of being remiss in doing this, but I do think, you know, if as consumers we hold our supermarkets accountable, then the supermarkets will go the extra mile to try and uncover, or to try and ensure that they do do their due diligence. Again, this key word around understanding their supply chain. And if they have any doubts where their avocados in this illustration come from, and the provenance of them, and you know, the governance structures behind them and all this sort of stuff, then pull back. You know, there's lots of other people who are growing avocados who you can buy from, or encourage avocado growth and farming in the UK, if it's even possible. I don't know. I'm not an agriculturist. I don't know if we can grow them. But, you know, you can stimulate local economies by doing that. You know, you can give, you can pay, you know, living wage to people over here, you know, encourage market growers and all that sort of stuff. So you can have a really direct impact on your community simply by not buying overseas, or wherever these avocados are shipped in from, Mexico in the case that you're giving, And so it's part of this whole bigger systemic problem, isn't it, in that sense of systemic shift, you know, where, again, you know, because somehow consumers demand that we have avocados all year round. Well, do we really demand that? Or do we now want it because we've been told we can have it because the supermarket shipped them in here back in the 1950s or 60s. So therefore we kind of grew up with them. But it's always thrown back at the consumer. Well, the consumer demands it. Well, you know, I don't demand it. I mean, I like them. But, you know, if they weren't there and we ate more seasonally, and I knew that that wasn't tainted by the prospect of criminality or modern slavery or things like that, I would, you know, you got to live by your values, haven't you? You know, or you choose to live by your values or you don't, you know. Again, that's a more ethical decision that you make as individuals.
But go on, carry on.
Don't. No, it's just about the accountability. That's kind of, you know, holding people to account, holding those who are in positions of power and purchasing power, hold them accountable for what they're doing. And that'll help to make things better. Same with fashion brands and stuff like that. You know, a lot of them are doing a lot of good, better and better work now in trying to understand their supply chains. But could they do more? Yeah, I'm sure they could do a lot more. You know, how come we're still getting the Uyghur people in China, you know, and the cotton that's being imported from China and stuff like that, you know, which is tainted by modern slavery. How come that's still happening? You know, we all know about it, so somebody must be turning a blind eye somewhere. So again, that's part of this bigger challenge about what are we prepared to give up a little bit to live our values. You know,
that's ultimately the issue, isn't it? Is that we are accustomed to a certain standard of living, and we are very much accustomed to fruit all year round and veg all year round, and we don't do seasonal. Like, you go to a restaurant and it says seasonal veg. It's just the same veg all year round. It's not seasonal at all, but that's just what we used to call it. We are accustomed to being able to, you know, and I wonder, you know, I question myself sometimes around kind of Amazon next day delivery. Like, it is amazing how they do it. But it also makes me question, how do they do it? Like, really? And if I put my safety hat on and my kind of operational kind of way of looking at it and think, that is some unbelievable pressure to get me, everyone, like everyone's on Amazon, a product within 24 hours. And I just think there has got to be something there. Like, I'm not saying that Amazon are an unethical company, but what I'm saying is it creates behaviors, it creates pressure, and it therefore creates behaviors that potentially make it very easy for exploitation of these more unethical practices, I think. So I think it's like, yes, we do need to know our values a little bit more. I do feel like society, the younger generations, are a lot more ethical and moral than maybe I was when I was a kid. 100, you know, I look at my kind of sister-in-law, like the stuff she's talking about, like, I did not know at her age. And I'm just like, yeah, there's so much more switched on. They're so much more ethical and moral. So that will help. But at the same time, like, I just think that I come back to the thing, like, in my head, I struggle so much with the concept of there is slavery in the UK. And in what I engage with.
Well, let's break that down a little bit, maybe, shall we? And just to sort of give it a bit of context, because, you know, the way that we were defining slavery before, you know, as I say, debt bondage, sexual exploitation, human trafficking, these things exist in the UK, but far, far over and above the biggest single form of modern day slavery, which we encounter in the UK, is around labour exploitation. And I think it's really important to make that, because officially, this is a really, really old figure now. It's something almost like a decade old. They reckon there was something like 13,000 slaves, modern day slaves, at any one time in the UK. Now, a subsequent piece of work, and these figures aren't considered very credible, not by me, but by the wider sort of modern slavery cohort. Mm-hmm. But that there was a later study done about 3 or 4 years ago, which estimates there's probably tenfold that figure. So the figure that most people bandy around, how many modern day slaves are there in the UK? It's 136,000 is the figure that people use.
What?
Yeah, 136,000 at any given time, which seems like a lot, but let's break it down. If you break it down into this labor exploitation, now it's what can be defined as labor exploitation. Now, labor exploitation on one hand can be the coercion piece I was talking about earlier, but it can also be if you're not paying someone the minimum wage. Okay, they could be prosecuted under the Modern Slavery Act for that. So that is when this figure, you know, and again, it's what lens are you looking at this issue of modern day slavery and how do you want to interpret it? But somebody could be considered enveloped in the modern day slavery statistics for labor exploitation if they are not paid minimum wage on a certain situation, you know, certain situations, given situations. So that's where this slightly might seem like a slightly inflated figure of 136,000 people comes from, because it includes that. But at the
still,
other end,
that is unbelievably unethical to pay somebody under that minimum wage, I think, because frankly, yeah. I think some of the jobs out there that are minimum wage just blow my mind. And I'm just like, how can you do that job and be paid that and barely survive through life? Like, I'm so lucky with what I've got and what I'm enabled to do. And I appreciate all that, all of the stuff that I have. But, you know, I come from minimum wage background, working full on working class, like two up, two down, council house. Like, mum worked like seven jobs, and it was like, you know, I just think even then, I think the minimum wage is just not enough to sustain not even a nice way of life. So then to pay somebody underneath that, for me, is a form of slavery, I think.
I mean, how can your mum have to work seven jobs? You know, let's, you know, if it was literally not seven all the time, but, you know, it sounds like she's doing at least two or three, if not four jobs at any given time.
Definitely.
You know, if people are being paid, you know, a proper wage, you know, a respectable wage for the work that they're doing, you know, based on their outgoings, on the minimum requirements, then, you know, how can that exist? How can, you know, that's just atrocious, isn't it?
But, yeah, I feel like some of it, Gordon, I feel like some of it as well is like maybe the decisions we make at, say, like a corporate level, we don't realise the potential gaps in that. So I'm thinking out loud, but the construction industry screams out to me here, like as a potential industry that could be quite easily exploited with the way that it's set up with subcontractors, everyone's self-employed, you know, it's a lot of, you know, it's not dodgy, but it's definitely gray, I'd say. Yeah. And I think like a lot of my friends work in the construction industry, and, you know, there's a lot of conversations at the moment about trying to get rid of this like self-employed culture that we have and put a lot more onus back onto the big companies. But at the same time, I talked to my mate and I said, like, you know, what would your appetite for that be? And he'd be like, no, because he gets a lot of benefits from being self-employed. Yep. But then I see it from listening to you. I'm like, God, there's a lot of room for maybe not, exploitation, but through maybe a bit of innocent naivety in a way.
I think case, but, you know, it's that naivety or ignorance on the path of employers, but in the law, in the eyes of the law, that does not excuse you.
Of course,
it's your responsibility as an employer to know what the minimum wage is at the very least, and to make sure that people have their human rights and their employment rights as well as their human rights taken care of in that situation. But it is complex. I run my own business, you know, so I'm self-employed in that respect, and I choose to work that way, and I make that work for myself. And I'm not, don't want to be patronizing here and say, well, that some people need more support, but some people do need more support, you know. Not everybody has the same abilities, has the same education, has the same opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. So those who are vulnerable, and let's face it, you know, it's the vulnerable that we're protecting here, you know. What's the saying? Something like society is only as good as its most vulnerable people and people in its society. So you have to, you know, have to take that as your baseline and protect those people at all times. You know, we're not unfortunately, I feel, and this is political, that, you know, we're looking after the, you know, the elite too much in our society, or those, you know, who are in power, and not looking after those who are the most vulnerable and the most exploited. So
I think there's a lot of, like, and maybe it's slightly just kind of tying off the back of that vulnerable in society. Like, I've worked in housing for a very short stint, and if I'm honest, I'm a flight guy. Like, if I can't make a difference, I just move on, and I'll get so frustrated and bang my head against a wall. And you know what? Fair to say that that's not good enough. But, like, I worked in housing, social housing, with some of the most vulnerable people, and just the way that we treated them, in my opinion, was shocking. And also, not so much the people on the shop floor, like the people on the shop floor that are really trying to help, say, like a homeless people, or they're running like a homeless kind of accommodation overnight kind of thing. You know, they love what they do. They love helping people, and they just do it for the love of it, you know. And they're the heroes of society that just kind of do this stuff and really do help people and do stuff like what you're doing. But then I think there's this disconnect because we don't really see it. I think there's a lot of work done to keep it out of sight. And maybe, I don't know, again, whether that's conscious work or unconscious work, but it's kind of like, again, it forces the general populace into this ignorance or this naivety that this is not a problem for us to solve, whether it's homelessness or slavery or exploitation or all of the above. Do you know, like, we then make an assumption that these people that are vulnerable, we go, oh, they brought in themselves, they're probably just druggies or something like that. Whereas actually, they're probably forced into that situation. To your point, they might have even inherited this slavery, which just blows my mind. Like,
I know. And that is, you know, that's often, isn't it, that, you know, the thing that's charged and leveled against people, you know, they bring it upon themselves. The homeless, you know, why is anyone homeless? It's their own fault, you know. Why, you know, why are they in modern day slavery? You know, if you've got any gumption, if you've got any nouse, if you've got anything about you, it wouldn't happen to you, you know. But it does, you know, it truly does happen to people who, you know, who, it's not just the, yes, it is the more vulnerable generally, and yes, it is the lesser educated, because they're generally in lower the sectors that are most vulnerable, to your point earlier, construction sector, agriculture, nail bars are quite prevalent in the UK. Wow. Bit of a hobby horse, but, you know, nail bars do seem to be an area where there seems to be a lot of traffic workers from Southeast Asia and places like that, Vietnam and places like that. There seems to be quite a lot of instances of that. Car washes, a lot of Eastern European gangs, people getting, you know, you get your car washed. Often you get, you know, but we all get our cars washed.
Don't even think about it, yeah.
And I bet you 9 times out of 10, they're East European lads who are cleaning your car. Now, that doesn't mean just because they're East European lads, they're getting exploited. But if I walk in somewhere and somebody's paying, and somebody's, you know, offering to clean my car for £9, you know, how much is the guy getting paid?
Do you know what? Like, it opens your eyes when you really, all you have to do is just start to ask those questions. Like, how is it? It comes back to that old saying, doesn't it? Like, if it's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. And it's like, actually, that's, we perceive that saying to be like, it will be us, it's us that's being exploited. But actually, from this point of view, it's not somebody else. And we used to go to a car wash, and I used to be with my mates, like, oh yeah, go to the car wash and find it. It's great, mate. £6, you get your car all done. And it's like, and now I'm like, Jesus Christ, yeah. And
Am I part of the problem?
Yeah, well, we are, aren't we? We're funding it.
We are funding it, and it's easy, you know, and I'm really not sitting in judgment, because, you know, I try to live my values, but I don't always live them. You know, I have had my car cleaned at these places, you know, and, you know, I do that. You know, I do use Amazon. You know, should I use Amazon? You know, well, no, probably not. If you actually look at the business model and you look at the way that it impacts upon, you know, the local community, and the high streets are getting closed down, not just because of Amazon, but because of everyone shopping online, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. It ain't good for our society. I know that, but I still do it because I'm a bit lazy.
Because you want it tomorrow.
Like, want it tomorrow. bit lazy. I don't want to go down the high street. And I, you know, occasionally when I do go on the high street, I can't find what I bloody want. And I get even more annoyed because I knew I could have ordered it yesterday on Amazon and I would have had it today.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is part of a bigger model, but I think, you know, it all begins with awareness, doesn't it? You know, going back to this, you know, educating ourselves, being open to the ideas around this and how, you know, can we actually do something about it ultimately ourselves? Well, you know, we can only do something if we actually understand the issue to begin with. And
what do you think about, like, because, you know, this where we're going with this now, Gordon, with this kind of path we've gone down, it reminds me a little bit of, so I'm a vegetarian, and more for kind of environmental reasons. I don't really want to get into that because it's a very sensitive issue or conversation, and I can't be arsed with it. But I've had it thrown at me. I'm not a very preachy kind of vegetarian either. Like, I'm just like, you want to eat meat? Cool, that's your choice, and it's my choice not to. I don't want to go anywhere else with this. So I don't preach about, I get preachy about some stuff, but I stick in my lane. It's safety, health, like, that's my place. And if it's outside of that, I don't get, tried not to get preachy. But anyway, my point here is that sometimes when I watch some of these, like, vegan people and they're like a bit more preachy about it, a bit more activism and vegetarian activism, any of that stuff, you commonly get that argument, and I could probably in part agree with, not wholly but in part, that these are kind of like, being vegan is kind of a middle to upper class thing because it's more expensive. So, like, being ethical is more expensive, which would make sense. Amazon is cheaper, the car wash is cheaper, and, you know, the Primark is cheaper, and, you know, all of these things where, and granted, some of the big brands have been caught out in fashion as well, but my point is that normally the thing that drives and creates a lot of this pressure is to get the price down for the consumer, and then the more we buy, the more we fuel it, and so on and so forth. So, like, it would be like, what would you kind of say to someone that maybe is listening to this, Gordon, and going, well, that's all well and good, Gordon, but I can't afford to shop here because it costs me more, or I can't afford to get my car washed there because it costs me too much money, or something like that. I mean, you could just wash your car yourself, but that aside, you know, do you know what I mean? It's a nice problem to have, but I can't afford to fix this.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it begins somewhere, you know, where this line, you have to draw this line, and I think it's part of a bigger systemic problem. As we talked about earlier, and, you know, I don't expect anyone to be a martyr for this, but, you know, if you have your own values and you have your own morality, and you know, we choose what we spend our money on. I mean, all right, unless you're in a situation where you are living on the minimum wage, and therefore, you know, it is, you know, you're really, really struggling. Most people have a certain amount of discretionary spend, and what they choose to spend on, how they choose to spend it, is. You know, it can be based upon these values and these decisions. Based on your own personal convictions and so on and so forth. And that may sound like, well, that's a middle class privileged position you're coming from again. But I do believe that if you don't draw the line somewhere on how you're going to spend your money and how you know which ethical choices you make, it's a kind of never-ending problem, and, you know, it almost gives license to the Primarchs of this world and people like that to continue. And Primark, to be fair, aren't, you know, do have a good responsible sourcing program going these days, but this continual drive to sort of, you know, buy you know, t-shirts for like £2 or £4 or whatever the price is, that you, this minimum price, you know. Why? I don't know. Again, it sounds judgmental, but, you know, I personally will spend £50 on a jumper, and I will wear that jumper. And I've got jumpers upstairs that are 8 years old, 10 years old. You know, may say, well, you're a bit of a tramp. You know, you don't care about how you look. Well, some people might say that, but, you know, I like to think I buy decent, well-made knitwear, for example. You know, that lasts me a long time, that is relatively, you know, not particularly, you know, obviously it can't be that fashionable, but it's going in and out of fashion because it's not going, you know, if I can wear it for 8 years and it still looks reasonable, then it's obviously not a fashion item. But my point here is, you know, this whole culture with the boohoo culture, for example, you know, where they sort of, you know, the fast fashion, you know, people literally wear something once and put it into the charity. Well, I'm sorry, but you know, this is judgmental. You can't be doing that. You can't be doing that as a sentient human being, because you have to understand that the cost of that is at somebody else's expense. If you know, if you're spending something, wearing it once and putting it in the trash. Environmentally, it's not sound. Sustainability, it's not sustainable from an economic, from an environmental, from a climate change, from all those things. And it has to be at someone else's expense from a social and modern slavery perspective, because nobody can make something for £2. It's just not possible. So think about the lifestyle that you're leading and thinking, you know, why do I need to feel like this pressure to sort of have a new item every other day, or, you know, every single time I go out, I have to wear something new. And that's.
But to be honest on that point, Gordon, sorry, I've kind of interrupted you mid-flow, but there's something that you said there that, like, so say, let's just say, for example, someone went, okay, but one of my values is I love fashion, and I want to be fashionable. I want to keep up with fashion, right? Therefore, I have to keep by the most up to date thing, right? My don't tell her I said this, right? But my mother-in-law is very trendy. She's like 60 something. She's very trendy. She's very fashionable, and she looks pretty good for her age, I tell you, right? And she lives for charity shops. She does not buy anything from Primark, from House of Fraser, from Gucci, you know, any kind of brand. She lives in charity shops. So people that turn around to me and said, you know, if anyone did turn around to me and say, do you know what, I can't to that because I want to keep up with fashion, that's passionate to me, are you telling me I need to stop that? No, you do what you do, but I'm telling you now, just go look in a charity shop, because I bet you can find something in there. I bet you can. So very, I think true. There is a part of it is more around, sometimes it's like we think that if we spend money on something and it's got the brand, then it'll automatically give us what we want, whether that is happiness or social acceptance or something. So we could go uber deep on this, we really could, but there is there's a, again, we come back to your earlier point, there is so much to this, it's so complex, isn't it?
It is incredibly complex, and you know, you can't unpack it all, because it is so interwoven with, you know, with all aspects of our life and all aspects of our culture and our history, you know, and systemic models that we live within. So it's really, you know, and from because it is so complex, it's why a lot of people don't engage with it, because it's too complex, you know, it's too complex. And it's like, well, what can I possibly do? I'm just me, you know, what can I possibly do? And I understand that, and I respect that as well. You know, not everybody wants to be an advocate or a crusader or an activist or whatever. It happens to float my boat. You know, but it hasn't always floated my boat. You know, I didn't, you know, I'm in my 50s and I didn't start advocating until I was in my 50s. You know, obviously as a journalist, I would write about stuff and I would have an opinion and a point of view, but I certainly wasn't, you know, an advocate as I am now, see myself now. So, you know, it comes for people, comes, you know, everyone has the right to, you know, to do what, how, you know, live how they want to live within the law, obviously.
I think there's a marginal gains piece that we could probably, you know, so they're like, it is, if everybody did one thing more tomorrow that they could, that was a little bit more ethical, be that maybe not go to the cheapest car wash, or be that just ask the question where that one product that you buy all the time that's uber cheap, where it actually is coming from. At one thing, and then next time you get a pay rise, maybe there's one more thing that you can look into. And whilst that's not going to solve the world's issues, I do think it would make a massive difference.
Yeah, I totally agree. And to your point earlier about, you know, what can you do? You know, you can do something at work. You know, you can raise these issues, you know, in your supply chain. You know, if your company that you work for doesn't have any responsible sourcing practices or policies, well, you know, you can raise that question at the next book, you know, the next you know, staff meeting or conference meeting or whatever it is you have. You know, just ask the question. You know, it might spark, you may find that it sparks the interest, you know, in your bosses or the people who have responsibility in the business. They may want to do it, because, you know, there are advantages to it. You know, there's efficiency advantages to you know, often involved with the more responsible sourcing practices. You know, there are soft in inverted commas, soft opportunities around it. You know, that, as you say, the millennials and the younger people these days want to work for companies that are being ethical, responsible. Definitely. So you're more likely to recruit good staff, good in commas, and retain your staff. You know, the cost of recruitment is a huge cost to businesses every year. So that helps you to retain your staff because, you know, you're looking after them and, you know, you have responsible practices and ethical business model. It's got to be beneficial in that sense as well. So it's a win-win scenario. You know, you're helping the greater planet in the case of environmental and you're, you know, lessening modern slavery and human rights abuses, and at the same time you're helping your own business. So what's not to get involved? Why wouldn't you get involved in that sense? It's a no-brainer in my opinion.
I think a big step for the corporate world would be just change the perception of your employees and just start caring about them a bit more, seeing them as assets, be them ones that are paid ethically and within, you know, or even be them ones that are paid really, really well. But I think from just, again, looking at the challenges that I have within my day job of kind of safety and so on and so forth, the way we treat the worker, it's always, and I'm only talking from my previous experience, but it's always an assumption that the worker is dumb, they don't know what they're doing, they turn up and they're the problem. You know, oh, Bob did something stupid again. And where we see, you know, as much as he's a bit controversial sometimes, but like, you know, Richard Branson has got to be one of the richest men in the world. And he's said it for years, you know, treat your employees well, they'll treat your customers well. So I think if we start changing how we perceive the worker, we see them as an asset, and we see that if we can care for them and go beyond the lines of compliance or whatever, it's just start saying, actually, no, I just want to do something. Do you need something? Yeah, I can't afford any milk this week. I'm going to get you some milk. I mean, that's what I'd do if I was employing someone. But, you know, and then someone might say, well, that's easy said than done. My business isn't. But that's just one example of just caring a little bit more. Then I think you'll probably start to spot some of these issues from a modern slavery point of view, being like, you know what, that lady, that man, that person, that young man, young child, young lady, they don't seem very happy when they come to work. And I'm paying the minimum wage, or I'm paying them more than minimum wage. Why are they turning up with shoes, the holes in their shoes, or something like? Do you know what I mean? There must be little signs that we're missing, and if we just kind of change the lens that we see the worker through, I think we could solve a lot of our issues.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think in many respects, you know, the occupational health and safety sector, you know, is a good example for how, you know, change can happen, because, you know, 20 odd years ago. You know, before there was, you know, I think it was probably in the 90s, wasn't it, when it really started to get ramped up, and it was probably no doubt a compliance issue, and maybe it still is primarily a compliance issue, but I do think it has a knock-on effect in you know, for issues around mental health, whereas when health and safety was first introduced, it was all about physical, wasn't it, physical health, making sure people weren't injured at work. Now, you know, shift. And again, you may say this is a middle-class problem or a middle-class issue, or it's perceived as, by middle-class people, as mattering. But I think the mental health movement, you know, at work, and you know, that was never talked about when I first started working in the 80s and the 90s.
It wasn't even talked about when I started working, and I'm only 30, mate. So
there you go. But now look at the shift. Everywhere, again, you know, talk about it, and maybe lots of businesses will say, you know, somebody admits to it, they'll probably have the piss taken out of them. But a lot more don't, you know, and even on construction sites. And there are lots of campaigns going on, you know, within CIOB and people like this in the construction sector, where they're supporting mental health awareness and all this kind of stuff. And if you like, making it, legitimizing it, making it okay to talk about these things, you know, and, you know, I think this is all part of this bigger sort of more compassionate, more considerate society, you know, where it's not all just about profitability. And if, you know, and if it's not a compliance issue, this is a beyond compliance in many respects. It is also, you know, from a share price perspective and things like that, because the investment community, you know, is massively looking at these issues of, as they call it, ESG, environmental, social and governance. And they are, you know, they are basically using their voting power what you know when the shares that they own in companies, to force them to actually look at these things and report on them and act upon them in meaningful ways. For example, again going back to Boohoo, it lost something like £1.4 billion on its share value because of the crap that went on in Leicester about the paying people the minimum wage, et cetera. But you know, people say, well, you know, doesn't really matter, doesn't affect businesses, you know, whether I do it or I don't, it might cost me a bit more. Well, actually, it can cost you an awful lot in your reputation, but also in your share price, in your ability to tender for government contracts, for example. You know, the government is now starting to put, you know, finally, the lack of leadership by the government has been appalling, despite the fact it says it's got the world leading modern slavery act. Well, yeah, it may have, or may did have, but it certainly didn't carry that through in its own procurement practices. So people were getting handed out government contracts who weren't even compliant to the Modern Slavery Act, which was absolutely laughable. But now they're starting to get the house in order so that, you know, that you can only get given a government contract. Not that everyone wants government contracts or is even in a position to apply for them, but I think it matters from a leadership perspective that it's been seen to get its own house in order. Yeah. But increasingly, you know, if you want to be part of a tender process, you know, again, for, you know, construction sector, for, you know, HS2 or, you know, any big infrastructure, motorways or anything like that, and you're part of a consortium, that consortium has to be, any public money essentially, has to be addressing issues around modern slavery and have a due diligence process in place and things like this. So it is gradually filtering. You've got the investment community, you've got consumer pressure, you've got top-down pressure from the government, you've got, you know, bottom-up from the consumer. You know, it is all coming into this sort of like melting pot where you have to address these issues or you're going to get left behind as a business.
How powerful would it be if you had, you know, people buying new build properties and they're like, how was this built? Who built this house? You know, and having that traceability, you know, like we're trying to do with it like we do so well in the food industry, within reason, other than Mexican cartels selling avocados, but we do it pretty well in the food industry that we can trace that coffee bean all the way back. You know, the fair trade coffee is kind of common practice now. Like you kind of don't really see any coffee that's not fair trade anymore. Like it's just common practice. So imagine if you're buying a house and you're just like, you know, right before, yeah, I really want to buy this house, but you know, everyone's starting to say, you know, can you tell me what you did to stop, you know, modern slavery? Because I want to make sure I don't live in a house that was built by slaves.
Absolutely. So there is that absolute transparency piece, and as you say, and traceability. You know, traceability of the products and where did the brick come from, for example? Yeah. You know, there is evidence of tainted. They call it a study that I read that was done by Royal Holloway University called Blood Bricks, where basically bricks are made in the likes of Cambodia and places like that, where they're basically building a lot of the buildings being built in Cambodia are basically through tainted supply chains. Jeez. Which is why they call it Blood Bricks. And there is some evidence that some of these bricks are getting into the UK. Although they shouldn't, because it's not, you know, they're not EU kite marked or CE kite mark or whatever it is. I'm not too up on that sort of thing, but you know, there are minimum standards obviously from a construction perspective. So it shouldn't be happening, but that's not to say it doesn't happen. So you know, that traceability, as you say, you know, there should, you know, again, whether it's the consumer who needs to demand that or whether it's legislation from, you know, as part of the home buying process, you know, that you should be given that, you know, in the same way that you do with an EPC certificate these days. Well, why can't that be extended? You know, that's a carbon perspective. That's from a carbon perspective, isn't it? The EPC generally, carbon and emissions to do with climate change and environmental stuff. But, you know, why not have it from a social aspect? You know, so you companies are forced to reveal where they're, you know, the responsible sourcing practices that they're doing. Yeah,
I'm like your house has a rating system of like ethical, sustainable, and safe. And where was it? You know, safe, not great. We shoved a load of crap down the cavity, but ethical, we're really good. We like this, and sustainable, we're probably somewhere in the middle. I get to make the decision then, an educated decision as a consumer. And I think the consumer, I think and I'm making a kind of overarching, I'm tarring them all with the same brush. I think, you know, the majority of us, like, we would be heartbroken to find out that we were contributing to something like that, but at the same time are so busy that it just doesn't enter our consciousness. So it's kind of like, yes, we need to ask more questions. Yes, we need to ask better questions. But at the same time, I think we also need a bit of support from the big brands and government, and, you know, to make this easy for us to make those ethical decisions.
100% agree. 100% agree. You know, just to say one point in that, modern slavery statements have to be publicly available. That one of the key conditions of the Modern Slavery Act is that all companies, again, only a turnover above 36 million, but, you know, most decent, medium, you know, decent, not in a pejorative sense, but most big companies will be talking over £36 million a year, and it has to be on the homepage of their website, and you can therefore click on it and you can read that. You know, now therein there is something of a challenge, because up until the recent regulations, there was a consultation done basically about the first 5 years of the Modern Slavery Act, and the initial legislation was found to be weak in very many areas. So they're now strengthening them, because you were compliant just by producing a modern slavery statement that says we recognize the need to do a modern slavery statement and signing it and putting a date that made you compliant. Yeah. So cute few doing that, but obviously those companies have been sort of like ridiculed for it. So, you know, why do that? So my point is, you can read, you know, as a consumer, if you want to look up, if you're thinking of buying a new home by Persimmon or Lang, or, you know, whoever else is out there building houses these days, those companies will all have a modern slavery statement, or should have a modern slavery statement. If they haven't got one, and they're turning over, and they're all turning over £36 million a year, obviously, with that sort of big national house builders, then you have to question, first off, why haven't they got a modern slavery statement? You know, and that would raise huge red flags for me as a consumer. And if I was buying a new home, and if they do have one, read it and see what it says, you know, and does it reveal anything about their lack of consideration, or, you know, do they address all the key main six compliance areas? Do they do it in a meaningful way? Do they do it in an ethical way? Do you know, are the development, a program of continuous development going, continuous improvement going on, et cetera, you know? So a certain amount of stuff is out there, you know, do we want to look at it? I think, you know, there is some stuff out there. So let's use what there is and push for more where it isn't.
So let's tie this in a loop, Gordon, and I'm kind of finish up about talking about what you're doing. So you're obviously covered in cycling gear. So that's not just because you find that really comfortable, I assume, to sit around in. It's to do with what you're doing. So why don't you tell us about what you're doing to kind of raise awareness?
Thank you. So back to Ride for Freedom. So Ride for Freedom is my passion. Communication is my skill set, and social justice my mission, if you like. So bringing those three things together, back in 2018, thought, what can I do to cycle more, raise more awareness, use my skill sets? Those were my objectives at the time. I came up with the idea to do a bit of cycling and did a charity ride on behalf of Unseen and Hope for Justice, two charities. And that sort of, you know, was the catalyst for it, for what's now become, you know, a social enterprise called Ride for Freedom, where we set up to do the challenges, cycling challenges, which motivate me, which hopefully people tell me inspires them, which is hugely gratifying. And quite a lot of people are now getting involved in the challenges that we put on, and riding alongside us. Some people are fundraising at the same time, with a view to, as I said earlier, the underarching reason that we're the motivation for doing this is to support this program called Free Will by Ride for Freedom, which is to support victims of modern day slavery in the UK with a new bike. So I'm seeing my challenges now, my cycling challenges, I call them my flagship challenges. The one I'm starting on Sunday, which is the 27th of June, is one where we're cycling around the 20 Premier League clubs in England, starting in at Wembley and cycling up to Leicester, then Leeds, Newcastle, Sheffield, Leeds, Newcastle, and then back down through the Northwest and the Midlands, and then doing the South Coast later, but all within a 2 week period. So essentially doing that to shine a light on the issue of child trafficking in sport, which is part of this modern slavery agenda, where specifically our kids are basically seduced in primarily in Africa, but also in other parts of the world as well. Invited to have trial, well, told that they can have a trial with a football club in Europe. And basically this is just a pretext for basically trafficking them into Europe. It's a big issue. There was a report, Trafficking in Persons report, which is a US government report, which is done annually. In the 2020 report, they estimated there are 15,000 human trafficking victims in football alone within Europe in that last study period. So 15,000 people, many of whom will be children and youths, because obviously those are the age when they, you know, they're attractive to the football industry, are being trafficked into Europe. And there's some really high profile cases, such as there's a player that Manchester United signed recently called Amad Diallo, who was basically trafficked from the Ivory Coast to Italy. United ended up signing him from Atalanta, which is an Italian team. And he was basically trafficked by a so-called uncle from his home in the Ivory Coast to Italy. And he was subsequently freed. You know, he got away from his oppressor. And now he's a legitimate Italian citizen, so therefore he has the right to play for Manchester United in the UK. But he's an example of how this happens. But there are, of course, he's one of the successes, if you like, of the trafficking situation, because this 15,000 people each year who are trafficked, they never make it to trial. There is no trial. They're basically just told that there's a trial, so that they get, you know, they come over to the UK, they come over to Europe, and wherever they land, are basically just, you know, put into these coercion, labour exploitation situations, where they're forced to work on building sites, you know, forced to work out in the streets, beg, borrow, steal, you know, whatever. Again, these aren't my figures. These are figures by the Trafficking Persons, which is a very reputable government agency for the US government, United States government. That's, as I say, this is part of the bigger issue. And this is the focus of this particular cycling challenge that I'm starting on Sunday. The context of it is that it's obviously the Euro 2020 tournament going on at this point in time. So it's a Europe-wide initiative, a competition tournament. And therefore, you know, it enables us to sort of use that to shine a light and contextualize this, why we're doing it now. So it's a great, it's a really good challenge. I'm basically be cycling about 1,000 miles over the course of a couple of weeks. Which is going to be quite a challenge, but I'm really, you know, really up for it and excited by it. And we've had phenomenal engagement from the football clubs. I think for the last count, a dozen of the 20 Premier League clubs have engaged with us, which is a mixture of attending a round table, which we're putting on this Thursday on the 24th, where it's going to be talking about all these issues and providing talking about, you know, some of the responses that they can make as football clubs to understand where the risks lie in their own business, back to this due diligence thing again, so they can start to understand how they're susceptible to it and how they can put processes and policies and processes and systems in place to ensure that they don't get this modern day slavery and child trafficking in their clubs, so they can protect themselves and the wider society from it. And also lots of them are, say about a dozen of them so far, have agreed to meet me when I rock up outside their clubs on my bike. Have photos taken, put it on their social channels, which, given the drawing card of all these clubs, you know, each social media post they do has
thousands, you
know, tens of thousands, all around the world. You know, let's face it, you know, the clubs like Liverpool and Manchester United, they have a bigger following in Asia than they do in the UK because of the number of people in it. These communities. So, you know, I'm hopeful that this messaging can really, really resonate, you know, and you know, let's and not get ahead of
you get foot. One kid yeah. pick up, just see that social media post or something that was about to be exploited by that trafficking system or is being, and they're like, oh, hang on a minute, what do you mean there's no trial and this is a big con? Like, just one is a win, you know. It's nowhere near enough, but you know,
But if that one is that, if you say if that one person or, you know, 10 people makes them question, makes them think twice, and that stops them from being one of those 15,000, that's phenomenal. You know, and sort of I was talking to somebody this morning, and he was we were basically saying that, you know, I'm basically going to be basically cycling 1,000 miles is about 1,500 kilometers, isn't it? So basically for every kilometer I'm riding, that's 10 kids or 10 people that are trafficked.
Wow.
Football in Europe each year. So I'm just, you know, I've got that very much in my mind now when I'm thinking about, you know, how do I do something about this? You know, each kilometer raises awareness around 10 potential for the potential to sort of illustrate it for 10 people, which is very powerful, very powerful. Really? So that's the first challenge that I'm focused on this year, first cycling challenge. And then the second one, just to wrap it up, is in give the context of it all. I'm doing a cycle ride from southern Spain back to the UK in October, which is just under 3,000 kilometers, which that route from southern Spain to the UK is a documented human trafficking route. So again, similar situation where wow. people are trafficked in Africa, and they're basically, you know, often on the pretext of work over here, they sign up to things and they, you know, the work doesn't exist. They, you know, as soon as they leave their own communities, they're basically taken control of by criminal gangs. They're sailed across the Straits of Gibraltar and places like that. You've seen all these issues of people, you know, human people are trafficked across from Libya and places like that across to Italy, and you know they're all being held in Greece and places like that. That's part of the same issue. A lot of those people aren't economic migrants. They're people who are trafficked people. You know, some of them are, you know, some of them did it for economic reasons because they want to better their lives. But basically, they've been trafficked along the way, and this is a huge situation, and this all falls under this modern slavery umbrella again. So I'm going to cycle back from Spain to the UK to shine a light on this human trafficking route, and yeah, that's my little gig. That's for gigs for this year.
That's amazing. That's amazing, mate. I think. That's really good. I really kind of struck. I didn't know that the one you're doing in October, but like, yeah, that's really powerful that you're riding the route that people are trafficked on. Like,
yeah.
It must be quite like when you're knackered and you're pushing yourself, especially if it's something like, it must get quite emotional. Like, I don't know. I'm quite an emotional guy, but like, I can imagine that when you finish that, or when you're riding that route from Spain, like, it's just so powerful that it just must be really emotional to kind of do it. And you've been doing this for years, so.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it does, you know, you think why you're doing this. And you know, of course, you don't think about it all the time, you know, but it reminds you, you know, at a certain time. Actually, my daughter made me, and I've taken it off because I had a shower earlier, but a bracelet that says End Modern Slavery. She made it out of beads. And I'm wearing that on my wrist, you know, most of the time, and certainly when I'm cycling now, as a constant reminder to myself, you know, this is not that, you know, I really need reminding because it's on here, but I don't tend to look at your jersey that often, but it's on my wrist. And, you know, there's a personal touch there, personal connection, because she made the bead for me. But, you know, it reminds me of why you're doing this. And, you know, this for every kilometer I ride, there's 10 people potentially, you know, are enslaved, kids trafficked in the name of sport. So yeah, it is emotional, and you know, and it keeps me grounded, and it keeps me focused on why I'm doing this, you know. And it's it goes back to that sort of thing. It's just unbelievable, begs belief that it can be happening in this day and age. And you know, if I can combine my love for cycling and make a bit of a difference at the same time, then yeah, all power to it.
Well done, mate. And I think change comes inevitably, but it comes slow, and it comes a conversation at a time, you know. And I strongly believe that. So that conversation that's obviously impacted your daughter now, that she's thinking about that at school or wherever she made that bead, and you know, that's in her head, and she's given that to you, that is a heuristic in her brain now, and that will live for the rest of her life. And she'll talk to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 people within the next couple of years through school and friends. And then that spreads and spreads and spreads and changes like a virus. So every conversation that you're having with people, you may talk to 10 and only one gets it.
but you know, that one will talk to 10 and then two will get it and it will go and it will keep going like a virus. So keep it up, mate.
Thank you, mate. Appreciate it. And thanks for your introduction and invitation on here. It's been great to chat with you. I really enjoyed it.
No, it's really been great. And maybe we get you back on once you're done, maybe October, and see how knackered you are and how it went and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. And part of that challenge is it's going to be a Guinness World Record as well. So, just to help shine a bit more light on it. Yeah. Obviously, a great, great pulling power around the world. The previous one I did, so, you know, I set a Guinness World Record last year. And I know the power of that now. So, though, you know, we're going to do a second one for this one. So, it all helps. Let's hope.
Amazing. So if people want to follow you, support you, work with you or whatever, how do they do that?
Best way to get in touch through social media channels, obviously LinkedIn, Instagram. I'm on there through Ride for Freedom, and the website is rideforfreedom.org.uk. So people can do that. They can donate if you want to donate, and the money that goes, obviously donated, goes towards the Free Will program. So there's a Just Giving page as well. So that's Just Giving Ride for Freedom. And it's all on the links to all the Instagram accounts and the Twitter account and LinkedIn and all that, all on rideforfreedom.org.uk. Yeah.
Nice one. We'll put all the links and stuff in the notes as well so people can click on there, make it a bit easier.
Nice. Perfect.
Mate, best of luck on the ride and keep up the good work, mate.
Yeah, and hopefully May see you on the way. If not, we'll wave as we pass Northampton.
Well, I've got your route, and I'm going to keep an eye on it. I've got a few days yet. You're going on a Sunday. We're recording today on the Tuesday, so I'm going to try my damnedest and make it work. Unfortunately, the two gents I was planning it with, they can't do it, but I'm going to give it a go. But if you see me, I'll let you know. If you don't hear from me, then you're a better man than I.
You'll know who I am because I'll be wearing this.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on, buddy.
Thank you, mate. Appreciate it. All the best.
Okay, peeps. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Gordon's just an amazing guy with a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of experience, and just a pure passion to just solving a problem, which I love. I love people like that. I can talk to people like that all day. And he's a cyclist as well, so that's cool. And I kind of love that he's raising awareness. I know I've been watching him on LinkedIn this week, and he's doing loads of work with Biffa at the moment, riding around, raising awareness with Biffa as well. So thank you very much, Gordon, for coming on. I hope you all enjoyed that conversation, and hopefully it'll help you in your day job. Don't forget to check out Project Meletium, the mastermind community for the safety and risk professional, and also don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance Learning Organization webinar and their HSE subscription service as well. I'll catch you next week. Safe.